There's a reason I asked that we do the Lord's Supper after the lesson this morning, and that is because I want to talk about some of the different prophecies of Christ and how they pertain to the fulfillment of those prophecies. And so it seemed better to do the Lord's Supper after such a lesson rather than trying to do two different talks on the same thing, with the same thing in mind. And so keep that in mind as we go through the lesson this morning. In 1 Corinthians 2, beginning in verse 7, the Apostle Paul wrote, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom of God, or which God ordained before the ages of our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew, for had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." This statement is intriguing to me because of all the prophecies that do and did exist concerning Christ, and yet they were still ignorant when it came to the crucifixion of Christ. When he came and they saw his miracles, there was evidence there that he was who he claimed to be. And yet they still crucified the Christ. And was there no warning that Jesus was coming? Was there no warning that the Messiah was coming? And it's true that the people during the time of Christ would not have known the exact moment. Much like we don't know the exact moment of the second coming of Christ. But there were prophecies concerning him. And some of the ones that we'll look at today, I believe, are a little more obscure. You have to stop and think about it. And perhaps it's easier to see how they were prophecies now than when they were spoken and written down. For instance, King David wrote a number of prophecies concerning Christ in the Psalms. And we don't often stop and think about David as being a prophet. You know, we think of him as being a man of God. We think of him as being this great king of Israel, a righteous man. But how often do we actively stop and think about him being a prophet concerning the coming of Christ? And yet there's a number of prophecies in the Psalms that point to the Christ. The people during his time, they were forewarned of through prophecy that the Christ would be coming, and to an extent that he would both live and die. And they were told through prophecy that the Christ would rise again from the dead. Well, I want to take a look at a couple of different passages this morning. First, turn to Luke chapter 24. We're going to read this passage here in just a moment. In Luke chapter 24, we are provided with the account of two disciples who are traveling from Jerusalem to a village named Emmaus. And this narrative actually takes place the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And these two disciples had heard what had happened at the tomb. This isn't widely known yet, so it's still happened pretty quickly. But this takes place the same day. You can also reference Mark chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. And I think that it's interesting that, you know, in the book of Luke, we're given a rather lengthy, detailed account of what happens. But in Mark, they get two verses that Jesus appeared to these two disciples, and that's it. But in Luke chapter 24, there's a rather lengthy account. In this account, we're told that the two disciples see the risen Christ, but that their eyes were restrained in verse 16, so that they don't know who he is. They don't know, they're speaking with him, but they don't recognize him as being the Christ. The risen Christ then begins to teach them what in this passage? Not just the things that he did while on earth. It says in the passage, which we'll read here in just a moment, that he started with Moses and the prophets and started to teach them about himself. You know, they don't realize at this point that he's teaching them about himself, but about the Christ. And so this is a rather intriguing passage to me, the way that he begins to teach them. Obviously, the Jews would have known a lot of things concerning Moses and the prophets and should have known should have known them, and yet they overlooked the meaning of so many of the prophecies. And think about, you know, we just went through this passage a few weeks ago in our Bible class. Paul before King Agrippa. You know, Paul does a very similar thing where he goes back to the prophets and he says, this is our teaching and here's how Christ fulfills those things. You know, that it's not something contrary to the old law, but rather the fulfillment of what God intended with the old law. And when he gets to the end, he says, Agrippa, you know these things. You know these prophecies. Do you believe? And so it's a very similar approach here. It's not unique necessarily in and of itself, except that Jesus is teaching it of himself. This is about me, even though they don't yet understand it. Well, let's take a moment and read this passage. Let's pick up in verse 13. You know, verses 1 to 12, we have the account of the resurrection of Christ and what happens surrounding that. And then we get down to verse 13. And it says, now behold, two of them were traveling that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they talked together of all these things which had happened. So it was, while they conversed and reasoned, that Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were restrained so that they did not know him. And he said to them, what kind of conversation is this that you have with one another as you walk and are sad? Then one of those whose name was Cleopas answered and said to him, are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? And have you not known the things which happened here these days? And he said to them, what things? And so they said to him, the things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified him. Excuse me. And this is one of those things that I thought was an interesting connection between this passage and what we read first from 1 Corinthians chapter 2, where it talks about our rulers have put him to death. And Paul says in 2 verses 7 and 8 that the rulers of this age knew, for if they had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Anyway, back to this passage. And we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened. Yes, and certain women of our company who traveled at the tomb early astonished us when they did not find his body. And they came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. And certain of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. Then he said to them, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe in all things the prophets have spoken. Ought not the Christ to have suffered these things to enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So he goes back and he says, here's all the prophecies about Christ. And now, of course, he's talking about himself. And at this point, they don't understand that connection. But he goes back and he starts talking about all of these prophecies. And he says, oh, foolish ones and slow of hearts to believe in all the things the prophets have spoken. They ought to have read, understood, and believed in all the prophecies. As I said, it's actually easier to look back from today and say, okay, well, here's how all these things fit, because we have them all written down. Not only the prophecies, but the fulfillment of those prophecies as well. What did Moses write about the coming Christ? And in some ways, what he wrote is part of the reason why there was confusion. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy 18, we go back and we look at what Moses did for the people of Israel, and it's understandable at the very least why people misunderstood what he said about the Christ, about the Messiah, the prophet. He says beginning in verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear, according to all you desired of the Lord your God in Horeb in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, nor let me see the great fire any more, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, what they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my voice, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. And if you shall say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if that thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken, and the prophet has spoken it presumptuously, and you shall not be afraid of him. So here we have quite a bit of information packed into a very brief passage. But here Moses is prophesying of the Christ, and there's going to be this leader. You know, the Christ is going to come, he's going to be a leader. And wasn't Moses a leader? So Moses led out of a physical earthly slavery. And so we kind of fast forward to the days of Christ. And you can understand their misunderstanding of what this prophecy was. You can understand that here they are under the rule of the Romans, and they see themselves in bondage, much like the Israelites were under the Egyptians. And so when this prophet comes, they say, well, he's going to lead us out of the Roman Empire. It's going to be this earthly kingdom that this prophet is to set up. So they misunderstand the application of the prophecy. Christ, unlike Moses, would lead out of the slavery of sin. And so it would be a different type of kingdom. But he would be a prophet. And he's called the prophet in this passage as well. Obviously, Moses was a prophet as well. He's doing that as, you know, in this passage that we're discussing. Christ often prophesied as well. And just a couple of things that he prophesied about would be his death and his resurrection, which came true. Which I find interesting in light of what we read in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Well, how do you know if a prophet is real or if he's fake? If the things that he says comes true, then he's true. Well, Christ rose from the dead, and therefore showing that he was the prophet. Another interesting point from Deuteronomy chapter 18 is that God says, I will put in his mouth the words that I want him to speak. So the things that came from Christ would be what God gave him to speak and nothing more. Turn to John chapter 12. John chapter 12, beginning in verse 44. John records a lot of the things that Jesus said that, quite honestly, sometimes are difficult to grasp. And sometimes you have to sit down and follow it verse by verse and make sure we get exactly what Jesus was saying. Well, I think these passages are, in some ways, those types of passages. John 12, beginning of verse 44, says, Then Jesus cried out and said, He who believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And he who sees me sees him who sent me. I have come as a light into the world, that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. And if anyone hears my words and does not believe, I do not judge him. And that's one of those passages where a lot of people kind of want to stop right there. Well, if you don't listen to Jesus, then he's not going to judge you. But they miss the point of what Jesus goes on to say. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. And so it's not that Jesus was coming into the world to judge sin. Sin was already sin. He was coming to save from that sin. Going on, he says, For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command that I should, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. And so this passage fits with what Moses prophesied about. Clear at the beginning of the kingdom of Israel, that this prophet who would rise up would only speak the things that God told him to speak. He would convey that message. Turn a couple pages over to John 14. Beginning in verse 6, Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is sufficient for us. Jesus said to him, Have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. So how can you say, Show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am the Father, and that I speak to you, that I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works? Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves. And so there's that point accentuated for us again, that Jesus spoke on the authority of God and only on the authority of God. There's a couple other things that I'll just make a quick reference to. You know, here in Luke 24, Jesus starts with Moses and the prophets to convey who he is and the fulfillment of those prophecies. If we go through the Bible, we see that this is common, that when those teaching the gospel in the New Testament, especially when they met with the Jews, or when they were trying to teach the Jews, that's where they would begin. They would start with Abraham and Isaac and Moses and the prophets, and they would lay it out for them and say, this is the fulfillment of those prophecies. Peter does the exact same thing in Acts chapter 3, 11 to verse to 26. Again, just a reference there. But he uses the prophecy of Moses to declare the gospel. It's not something contrary. That was the will of God leading to the fulfillment of his overall plan. I do want us to think for a few moments about some of the things that David wrote. And we'll come back to David again in a few minutes as well. Turn to Psalm 2 and verse 7. As I noted earlier, that David actually prophesied fairly frequently about the Christ. And again, this is one of those areas where it's probably easier for us to look back and say, okay, here's what David wrote, and so here's the fulfillment of that. And now we can see how those two things tie together. 2 and verse 7, he says, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, You are my son. Today I have begotten you. There's a few different things, and this may be the specific fulfillment of that, but he declares about Jesus that he would be the Son of God. Turn to Matthew chapter 3. Matthew 3, beginning in verse 16. When he had been baptized, Jesus came up immediately from the water. Behold, the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting upon him. And suddenly a voice came from heaven saying, This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And the connection that I see between these ones, or these two passages, is that Jesus was declared by God to be the Son of God. And so here David is writing, you know, about this person in the future, who would be that prophet that Moses spoke about, that we know of as Jesus, who is the Christ. And he says he will be declared as the Son of God. And we see just one such instance like that in Matthew chapter 3. I don't believe that's the only instance that we see that evidence. But it's kind of hard to miss this declaration in Matthew chapter 3, isn't it? That this would be the declared Son of God. That God would claim him as his son openly. There's a few other things that we can look at. Turn to Isaiah 53. The truth is, I think you could take Isaiah 53 and you could connect the thoughts from Isaiah 53 to a lot of different things in the New Testament. And you could have an entire lesson come just from Isaiah 53. Maybe a whole series of lessons. I don't know. It's possible. I don't want to do that necessarily this morning, but there is one passage that I want to look at here. Remember, we just looked at Jesus being declared the Son of God. And yet in Isaiah 53 and verse 3, it says, He is despised and rejected by men. Now think about this. He's despised and rejected by men. The Son of God, the declared Son of God, is despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. So here is the Son of God who would be despised, and we people would hide their faces from him. Now, I think there's a lot of different applications that we can make from this, and I just want to look at a couple possibilities this morning. Turn to John chapter 1. In John chapter 1, beginning in verses 10 and 11, it says, He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. So think about the power that is encompassed in that verse. In verse 11, he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Very much like what Isaiah wrote in Isaiah 53, hundreds of years before even the birth of Jesus, that he would be rejected, and that his followers would hide their face. Turn to John chapter 7. This passage always intrigues me because we know that at least some of the brothers of Jesus would later come to be obedient. They would later come to believe as to who he is. But in John chapter 7, they don't believe. They're not followers of Christ. Beginning in verse 1, it says, After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now, the Jews' Feast of the Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples may also see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For even his brothers did not believe in him. Rejected by even his own brothers. And again, this is one of those areas where it might be somewhat understandable that they would not necessarily become followers right away. Can you imagine that if your own brother stood up and said that he was the Son of God? What would your reaction to that be? Now, as I said, we know that at least some of his brothers later became Christians and followers of Christ. And that, to me, that's why this passage is actually intriguing, that they so wholeheartedly rejected him at this point. But here he is, he's rejected even by his own brothers. Now turn to Luke chapter 22. And again, this is just one passage that we can point to. We're going to pick up in verse 54 and read down through verse 62. But think about what Isaiah wrote. That even his followers, those that might have believed in him at one point, would hide his face from him as he was despised. Verse 54, Having arrested him, meaning Jesus, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. But Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, This man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, Woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, You also are of them. And Peter said, Man, I am not. Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, Surely this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean. But Peter said, Man, I do not know what you are saying. Immediately, while he was speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So Peter went out and wept bitterly. And so I like this account of Peter's denial. And for a number of different reasons. But if we think about what Peter does when he denies Christ, is he not essentially hiding his face from Christ? You know, does that not essentially fill that part of the prophecy? And again, as I said, there's a number of different ways we can look at that and make different connections into the New Testament. But one of the things that is unique about this, this recording of the event is that it says that Peter was within sight of Jesus. Because when he denied him the third time, Jesus turned and looked at Peter. Jesus knew what Peter was doing. Can you imagine? Just think about it. And again, this is one of those passages I think you could probably come up with an entire lesson, and maybe I will someday, where just thinking about, you know, if Jesus were standing there and looking at us, would we do some of the things that we do? Would we act in some of the ways that we act? But that's one of the reasons that I at the very least, appreciate this version of the account. Here's Jesus, the Son of God, the declared and proven Son of God, in front of him, and he denies him to the point, and he even does it when Jesus can see him. What about the tormented Christ? Turn to Psalm 69. Psalm 69, verses 19 to 21. You know my reproach, my shame, and my dishonor. My adversaries are all before you. Reproach has broken my heart, and I am full of heaviness. I look for someone to take pity, and there was none. And for comforters, but I have found none. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. And to me, it just seems like that's a pretty direct connection. Turn to Luke 23. Luke 23, beginning in verse 35, it says, And the people stood looking on, and even the rulers with them sneered, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ, the chosen one. The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine, and saying, You are the King of the Jews, save yourself. Now turn over to Matthew 27. And you'll want to keep your finger in Matthew 27, because we're going to come back to this passage in just a moment, after we look at another psalm. Matthew 27 and verse 33. I must have written down verse 34, I'm sorry. And they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. And when he had tasted it, he would not drink. And it seems like these connections, you know, are obviously there. And they're such, in some ways, almost insignificant prophecies. You know, this isn't something huge and ground-shaking, earth-shattering, however you want to phrase that. So it's not like, well, okay, here's Jesus and we want him to fill this void. Let's go back to this random psalm and see what David wrote there about the coming prophet. And let's just make sure that we fill this part of the prophecy. You know, so that Jesus, we kind of force him into that role. Nobody would have done that. And yet, here we have those connections. Keep your finger in Matthew 27 and then turn back to Psalm 22. Psalm 22, beginning there in verse 16. For the dogs have surrounded me, the congregation of the wicked has enclosed me, they pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones, they look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. This may be one of the most obvious of prophecies that we are presented with. Matthew 27 again, beginning in verse 33. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, the place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. And when he tasted it, he would not drink. And they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Sitting down, they kept watch over him there. It seems pretty obvious that this is a direct connection between what David wrote in Psalm 22 and the fulfillment in Matthew 27. Psalm 16. I guess perhaps I should have prepared the slides and put them side by side, but I guess I need to get back into that rhythm myself. Psalm 16 and verse 10. Again, it is written here that in verse 10, for you not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. And then turn over to 49 and verse 15. Psalm 49 and verse 15. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, and he shall receive me. Now turn over to Matthew chapter 28. We'll read verses 1 through 8. Now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. His countenance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow. And the guards shook for fear of him, and they came and became like dead men. But the angel answered and said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, as he has said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay, and go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead. And indeed he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you. So they went out quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to bring his disciples word. Just think about the prophecies of Jesus' resurrection. And these aren't even including the ones that Jesus himself made. These are ancient prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. Jesus himself also made such prophecies about his death and resurrection. And he fulfilled them. So like, the stipulations that Moses had placed on a prophet, a true prophet, Jesus fulfilled them, as did David, as did Moses himself, and so many others. Turn back over to Luke 24. We'll start to wind down with this passage here. Luke 24. After Jesus teaches these two disciples so much of the prophecies and how Christ had fulfilled them, how Jesus had fulfilled them, he finally reveals himself. Let's pick up in verse 28. Then they drew near the village where they were going, and he indicated that he would have gone farther. But they constrained him, saying, abide with us, for it is towards evening, and the day is far spent. And he went in to stay with them. Now it came to pass, as he sat down at the table with them, that he took bread, blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished from their sight. And they said to one another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us on the road, and while he opened the scriptures to us? So they rose up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem, and found the 11 who were together, with them gathered together, saying, "The Lord is risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." And they told about the things that had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of bread. And I think this is an interesting connection that, you know, here's Jesus and he's kind of the guest, isn't he, in this instance? And yet it seems to be that he's the one who takes the bread. He's the one who breaks it, blesses it and breaks it. And in that act is when their eyes are opened and they realize who is with them, that it is Jesus. Now, whatever Jesus had done to restrain their eyes that we saw in verse 16, whether he lifts that here, whether they just finally understand that's who he is, I don't know. You know, there's a lot that we could, you know, assume, I suppose. But Christ reveals himself and they believed. They saw the evidence that Jesus had taught them and they refer back to that. They understand that what Jesus was teaching them. And they believe what they had witnessed. Over the last couple of months, and this is a kind of an ongoing thing that I think about and study through, you know, we've looked at the different evidence that pertains to the existence of God. The world itself stands, I think, as evidence of this existence. But beyond that, the children of Israel had the prophecies pertaining to the coming of Christ. So they could see the natural world. They believed in God. You know, they knew God existed, but they had the prophecies of the coming of Christ. Once the two disciples on the road to Emmaus saw the evidence that Jesus showed them, they were fully convinced of his true identity. They saw the prophecies and they saw the fulfillment of them. That's really the strength of the gospel, that there is these prophecies and that Jesus fulfilled them. A lot of people try to deny, and we've been talking about this in our Wednesday evening Bible class, that, you know, Isaiah was written when Isaiah was written. Obviously it was. Obviously it was long before the coming of Christ. And Jesus fits those prophecies. And there's so many others, of course. The Bible is full of them. You don't want me to try and cover every one in a lesson. I'm sure. If they saw all these prophecies contained in the writing and the writings of God's people had come true, what does that teach us about the prophecies made by Christ and by the apostles? In other words, think about what we have in the New Testament concerning the second coming, what God expects of us. That we understand that they will come true as well. We don't know necessarily when. We don't know when the end of the world is going to come. I think it was, September 23rd that it was projected for this year. Well, it is now, you know, November 5th. I don't want to lose a whole month. November 5th, and the world is still going. So, obviously, that is not true. And by the stipulations that Moses put down in Deuteronomy 18, we don't have to be worried about the person who made such a prophecy because it didn't come true. But we can look at the scriptures and we can look at the prophecies that are contained in that. And we can think about Christ in that manner. Think about who he is. Keep these things in mind as we partake of the Lord's Supper here in just a few moments.